Now, but we've got to go over some, I think, some very helpful ways to tend to bring cortisol down. Although, obviously, the most important thing is to address the actual reason for the stress, obviously. So I'm going to talk about how, and this is sort of like, I pass this out to every patient that comes in when I once identify the fact they have stress, for whatever cause may be. Exercise, we'll go over that, how it works and how it helps. Yoga, meditation, 30 minutes a day. Breathing exercise, I'm going to talk about that in detail. Vitamin C, magnesium, the Zen, which is Rezin, melatonin, and then, of course, try to reduce the stress as much as possible, and that's so important. So start out with exercise. Now, I know that exercise, we all hear about exercise is important. There really has been a lot of work done. Our body reduces temporarily, increases cortisol the first few minutes or so we exercise, but really, in the long haul, as we get to basic exercise for up to about an hour and a half or 2 hours, it actually decreases cortisol. Basically, Dr. Kuhlman, Suze Kuhlman showed at kinesiologist at Yale that actually raises one's heart rate for and reverses the damage to the brain caused by stressful events. Stress atrophic atrophies the brain, especially the hippocampus. Actually, cortisol will destroy the cortex. It actually destroys part of the upper cortex. It actually destroys also a layer of the gut. And the gut only has a one cell layer, actually. So cortisol will actually destroy and actually affect the memory of the brain. So you see that when you're stressed out, you begin to forget things. And that's one of the common reasons why it happens. But the Internal Journal of Allied Health Sciences says studies show that at least 30 minutes every day of moderate exercise helps reduce cortisol levels. But I said earlier this morning, unfortunately, those who do marathons can actually increase cortisol after about 2 hours. So 2 hours of exercise or more can be shown to increase cortisol. And that's why a lot of these runners have real thin legs, have a lot of good stamina and longevity, but they just have little bit thin legs because they burn muscle. Mm-hmm. See? Cortisol, as I showed earlier, actually burns muscle if it's too high. But nonetheless, we can really see that it's important not only for your stress, but for your heart, obviously, it's important. Now, yoga is something that I've always recommended to my patients to practice because yoga is a mind-body practice. It's considered one of the most big types of complementary integrative health approaches. Now, yoga brings them basically together the physical and the mental discipline that may help you to what? To achieve peaceful of mind and body. And I know that, you ever tried yoga yourself?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's great. I mean, how about the hot yoga? That's something I haven't tried
yet.
Oh, 105 degree, whatever it is. Well, I tell you, it's a workout. But it helps you relax, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yoga's great. And I think that's what helps you relax. It helps manage stress and anxiety. Core components are the poses. Now, these are the things that's hard to do. Somebody has a back problem, you know, has joint issues. Sometimes it's hard for them to go to all these poses. But the poses, also called postures, are a series of movements designed to increase the strength and flexibility. Of course, the poses range from lying on the floor while completely relaxed to difficult poses, postures that may have to stretch your physical limits. That's one of the problems we see with yoga. But breathing is also important, and we'll go over breathing even more detail here in a few minutes, how breathing helps to reduce stress. It's an important part of yoga. It teaches them that controlling your breathing can help you control your body and quiet your mind. And that's so important. Meditation and relaxation is also in yoga. They incorporate meditation with relaxation. And these are important because meditation will help you to be more mindful and, of course, aware of the present moment without judgment. So I think yoga is great. And I have a lot of patients that do yoga. I have a yoga instructor who's under stress. He'll say, well, how can that be? Well, she has all the other problems besides that, so she's under stress too. Now, meditation is something that I really do promote as a third lifestyle change. And meditation has been basically shown to be very effective. Researchers at Johns Hopkins sit through about 19,000 meditation studies and found about 47 trials that addressed these issues and met their criteria for well-balanced studies. And what they found was, and published in the Journal of the JMA of Internal Medicine, that mindful meditation can ease psychological stresses like anxiety, depression, and pain. And so a simple technique, practice a few minutes, at least 10 minutes a day. I tell people to do it for 30 minutes a day to meditate, but they say, well, I don't have time for that. Well, that's because you're stressed. You're too busy. Take time for it. You got to organize your time. You got to have priorities in your life. And I think that it does help to decrease anxiety, improve cardiovascular health, achieve greater capacity for relaxation. So the technique is called relaxation response. It's pioneered by a U.S. Harvard physician, Dr. Herbert Benson, in the 1970s. So I think that meditation should be an active part. Now, people say, well, I pray. He said, well, I like prayer. I think it's great. But when you pray, you're not relaxing. You're reaching out. But that's okay. But I want you to meditate, too. That's important. Now, breathing exercises. Now, this is important because, as I showed you in the HRV, how that particular part of the HRV software has the ability to provide some breathing exercises that will help to increase that part of your mobility. And I'll show you how that works now. But we have baroreceptors in our arteries, in our aorta, and several different arteries. What it does, baroreceptors dictate change in arterial pressure, sends a signal to the glossopharyngeal nerve up into the brain, down to the vagus nerve, and adjusts the heart rate. Now this process then is what is utilized when we actually take a deep breath. It sends basically a message up to the medulla oblongata, and the vagus nerve then sends to the sinus node, so we can synchronize our breathing that begins to cause increase in our heart rate variability. It's a real interesting process that takes place. So as you take a deep breath and let it out, the heart variability will begin to synchronize, and you'll see that happening. I'll show you in a graph here in just a moment. But what happens when we take a deep breath? That puts into a sympathetic phase. Secondly, there's a negative thoracic pressure. Thirdly, it dilates the bronchi all the way up, exchanges the O2 and CO2. That's what maximizes that exchange. Blood vessels in the chest expand. The arterial pressure decreases. Arterial concentration occurs. And then the net arterial flow goes down and the venous flow accelerates. That's what happens when we breathe in. When we exhale, we find it's the opposite, called a parasympathetic response. Positive thoracic pressure. As we exhale, bronchi then constrict, let all the basically the air out. Kind of comes the carbon dioxide. You know, we talk about that, how that incomes good air out goes the bad air. That's what it's all about. Bronchi constrict, release all the carbon dioxide. As max the exchange of the two is minimized at that point, because it's all coming out through the trachea, through the bronchi. Blood vessels in the chest shrink, arterial pressure decreases, heart rate decreases, arterial relaxation occurs, then arterial pressure increases, arterial blood flow accelerates. So just the opposite that occurs with the sympathetic phase. So it's sort of summarized here, where we see sympathetic response is going to be increased breathing rate, decreased breathing rate. Increased heart rate, decreased heart rate. Decreased heart rate variability, increased heart rate variability, increased blood pressure, and decreased blood pressure. Our goal is to synchronize that to where the heart rate variability is increased as we take in a deep breath and synchronize it over a period of time. Now, so this graph shows us how this occurs. As we begin to take deep breaths, we begin to see a synchrony between the breathing and the heart rate variability. And that's what we're looking for, and that will relax you. Matter of fact, there's a doctor, Dr. Luis Roland, who is a professor of endocrinology at the University of San Pablo, Brazil. He's my consultant, one of the two consultants I have in the world on my condition that I'm talking about in a few moments. No one else in Austin, Houston, knows anything about this. So I had to go to San Pablo, Brazil, at Eastern Virginia to find someone who knows what I'm doing. And he has written a paper about this particular exercise where he says if you do this exercise, I'm going to show you in about a couple of minutes or so, do it at least twice a day for 15 minutes. You can reverse this condition called diabetic cardiovascular autonomic neuropathy, which is a condition that is really interesting. So just breathing for 15 minutes twice a day will help that condition significantly and help stress significantly. So if we look at the fact, this particular software called IOMPE is a software I started using several about a year and a half ago. And what it does, it basically, we look at the fact the IOM detects a subtle, the mind body signals to send to the Wild Divine software. The software reacts to signal from the IOM and user receives feedback. User adjusts to feedback, improves current levels of tension, stress, and relaxation state. So it's a real interesting way how you can improve your heart rate variability as you improve your respiratory rate. Now, what is biofeedback? This is a type of biofeedback, what it amounts to. Biofeedback essentially is a way for a human to interact with a machine. For example, a computer, keyboard, mouse, or touchscreen on a phone are examples of biofeedback devices. And what it does, the biofeedback, like the Wild Divine, which was what we're using here, I'll show you today, allows for your body to very subtle biological signals to the control of a computer, much the same way that a mouse and a keyboard can. What this means in practice is that the IOM makes it possible for the Wild Divine software to detect and analyze your mind and body's very subtle signals of stress, calmness, tension, relaxation, and emotions to provide feedback on your meditative state and suggestions regarding how to improve it, no more wondering, how am I doing? This really is interesting how this works. Now, this is one of the several parts of the software you can get. This is called the Heartscapes. And this is the screen that comes up when you have the first, you first open up the software. You go to play, and you pick out your degree of difficulty. And I have mine set at 76 and 12 for the breathing cycle. And it gives you about six different programs. They're all different. They're all very, really interesting. Matter of fact, this one right here, I know Dickie says she loved this one here called Call of the Wild. What happens is that animals come in drinking water. As you're taking a deep breath, the animals come in very slowly and drinking water. There's birds in the background. It's a real calming type of thing. All of these are different, but I like to use the called coherence flow. What the coherence flow is a continuous flow of this device here. There's no end to it. It's always moving, but there's no end. And you can set it for 5, 3, 5, 10, or 15 minutes. I usually use about 10 minutes twice a day. So you start the actual device, the program for working, and your butterfly wings open up, and you take a deep breath that says, inhale, and then the wings close, it says, exhale. You follow this for 10 minutes, and what happens is it changes colors from yellow to green, to blue. Now you want to keep it blue all the time. Otherwise, that tells you you probably have your heart rate variability is pretty much close to your breathing rate as you want to see it. So what I've done, last year I did it over a period of months, and you can see over time, I improved, give you a success rate in percentage. 79, 87, and this is about 89, I think it was. But my best one was this one, 93. So you see that you can actually measure your success of trying to get these two to match up so you have better heart rate variability. So this is something I thought was really nice. It tells you congratulations, you pat yourself on the back, that you've done a good job. Now the company was sold, so now Wild Divine now belongs to a company called Unity. Now the thing about it is that it's the same software, but it's been expanded to even have more attributes to it. So they've actually had about 15 years experience with the two combined. It's users globally over 100,000, and a lot of protocols that show how this works. It's pretty much been defined as a very, very useful device. So we've had about five generations of devices, so it really has been studied over and over and over again. And if you look at the fact that it's a single device, it basically biofeedback that tracks heart rate variability and galvanic skin response that works across computers, tablets, and smartphones. The nice thing about it is the involving library contains over 100 guided meditations and 30 gaming experiences. So it's even expanded even more. And also updated with a new look and a feel and ease to use interface. Lastly, a cloud-based, which is nice, dashboard that actually, you know, will track your progress over time. Access all the actual titles in a single login across all platforms and files. So it's really a unique process, and it's cloud-based, which makes it even better. Here's an example of their start screen. This says start. You can have their report screen a bit different than you saw on the other one. They actually give you the beats per minute and give you percent, which is your coherence. This was 50%. Mine was up to 93%, and the time that you actually spent during the actual study. Their dashboard is, as I said, is cloud-based, which makes it unique. One login to review your progress, track your user progress is real-time, data export functionally, it works with data on Excel with a CSV file. So it's a pretty good program, and I think this is something, like I said, I've used it for almost a year and a half, and I've been really pleased with it, with the actual, basically, Wild Vine, which is the same thing, but this one expands out a little bit more. Now let's talk about vitamin C. Well, vitamin C is something that has been reported as an important cofactor in both the adrenal gland and the adrenal medulla, the cortex and the medulla. The adrenal gland is one of the organs with the highest concentration of vitamin C. I didn't know that about a year ago. And actually, interestingly, both the adrenal cortex and the medulla accumulate such high levels of ascorbate. Ascorbic acid is a cofactor required for both catecholamine biosynthesis and in adrenal steroidal genesis. Now, animal models and various cell structure culture studies confirm a crucial role for vitamin C for both the adrenal cortex as well as the adrenal medulla, and further underlying the interdependence of the two endocrine systems united in one gland. Now, this is important. Vitamin C utilizes the production of adrenal hormones, most notably the cortisol. So when you're faced with a stressful situation, your vitamin C, what? Is rapidly used up in production of cortisol and related stressors. But guess what? As you go through the fatigue part, where you utilize it to the point where you're exhausted almost, as far as the receptors have been blunted, and you have so much cortisol, the adrenal gland panics when you don't have enough vitamin C, and in what seemed to be a paradox, they actually release more cortisol. This is what's so interesting. The more stress you have, the more cortisol is released, and the vitamin C is depleted even more so. Therefore, it's important to add vitamin C as part of the treatment. So I take 5,000 of vitamin C every day. And I think this is something that clearly has been shown of this paradox, that the more stress you have, the more vitamin C you need. You know, it's really interesting how this has correlated. So vitamin C, 5,000 a day, is not taken all at one time because you can't absorb it all. I just take it 1,000, you know, five times a day. And that seems to be something that helps. Over the last couple of weeks or so, I've been trying something interesting because I'll show you why as I get toward the end of the talk. I've been taking also IV vitamin C, 50,000 milligrams a week, along with 150 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid. And what this does, it helps to regenerate the nerves, my vagus nerve, which has been compromised by diabetes. But I'll talk to you about that in a few minutes. People say 50,000 milligrams of vitamin C, oh my gosh, that'll kill you. Hadn't done it yet. So you see, vitamin C, if you look at some of the studies that have been done, 80,000 milligrams a day for 8 weeks has cured things like stage 4 cancer of the kidney in reported cases. So a lot of things should be done. The reason why they don't want to do anything about it because the oncologists don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that you can cure cancer with something like vitamin C, which is $100 a day. So times 60 days is $6,000 versus $200,000 or $300,000, of which they get paid to sell the chemotherapy drug. So you see, this is another part of it. Worth contemplating maybe someday offering vitamin C intravenously, but we're only doing it right now Myers cocktails, which is a little different. But my point is, vitamin C is important. I get off the subject, but vitamin C is really important to replace if you're stressed out. Now, so is magnesium. Magnesium is one of those things that is deficient with stress, shown clearly in studies. And therefore, issues of their relationship, diagnostic studies, approach to therapy were written in Russian. Mental and physical stressors cause an increase in magnesium elimination from the body. So magnesium deficiency, in turn, enhances the response to stress by paradoxically, again, aggravating its sequel. That's another paradox. So you have to add some magnesium to the mix. So I tell people to take 150 milligrams, 1 to 5 a day. Now, if you have diarrhea, you take it too much. No, it's milk of magnesia. They're constipated. You have to back off a little bit. But I think magnesium is another important thing. Now, whatever, we're trying all these things we can do to bring cortisol down, but we haven't hit the most important thing yet. So we're getting to that in just a minute. But these things help, by and large. Now, the one product I think that has been, to me, the most helpful is Resin. Resin has been something we've been using now for, a year and a half. I think it's been, we have it in all six of our clinics. The reason why I like it is it contains a whole lot of good products. And I'll go over each one of these as to what their benefits are. Because the product, I haven't seen anybody have a side effect yet. I take it every day myself, but I want you to look at some of the benefits you see with each one of these products. So if you look at the first one, L-theanine. You know, L-theanine is in green tea. I call it a natural Xanax, so to speak. But if you look at what it, how it does, it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is really important when it comes to stress. Promotes GABA production, stimulates the production of alpha brain waves, clearly relaxes the focus of production of energy, and lasts for hours. Diminishes PMS symptoms. I use for PMS patients as well. It seems to help. Improves learning abilities, heightened mental acuity, promoting concentration, supports the immune system. And remember, the immune system is so important to prevent what? Cancers, viruses, bacteria, I mean, infections of all kinds. Our immune system is important. Lowering the blood pressure acts antagonistically against the paralysis induced by caffeine. I'm not sure how much paralysis you get from caffeine, but I guess we do some. I don't know. Then GABA. Well, GABA is a really important product. Why? Because GABA is called the natural calming agent for the brain. This is what we hear about all the time. Promotes relaxation and ease of nervous tension. Stimulates the production of growth hormone, builds muscle mass, and burns fat. That's what growth hormone is all about. Clinic helps the treatment of, again, this helps. It didn't say it cures, it didn't just say it helps. People say, well, you have these, all these things that's supposed to cure. No, no. It helps in alcoholism. It helps in ADD. It helps in stress, Parkinson's, PMS, anorexia nervosa, bulimia, chronic fatigue syndrome, Wilson disease, fibromyalgia, and depression, obesity. Just additional help to help to relieve symptoms of what we're talking about. Now, what are the 11 main factors that reduce GABA levels in the body? That's why we want to look at these, because that's why we add in something to bring GABA up. Exposure to loud noise. Loud noise will actually decrease GABA in the brain. Second, excessive electromagnetic radiation. Lower levels of B1 and B6. This is what I worry about. We were talking about that with John a while ago. All these kids with all this loud music and all the telephone up to your ear. I'm wondering if we're going to see some real stress problems with our kids because of that. I worry about that for sure. Low levels of vitamin B1 and B6, low levels of iron, zinc, and manganese, high amounts of caffeine. Wow, I have guys that in my office that would drink up to 10 cups of coffee a day. I'm wondering how that affects their GABA, basically, elevation. Chronic pain, exposure of lead and mercury, not enough sleep, and low levels of progesterone. That's another thing. Chronic pain, I mentioned, is a cause of high cortisol. And you wonder also if that is also a cause of low GABA. This is why we use Resin, because it elevates GABA, which may help in the chronic pain as well. See? So we use GABA for many reasons, because it does help with chronic pain. And also with PMS, we use progesterone, but GABA basically is also important because it will help the symptoms of PMS. Now, ashwagandha, this is really important. This is one of the more important ones, I think, too, because it helps to protect the immune system, which is something that is so important when it comes to cortisol effects. Helps combat the effects of stress, but also has improved in memory and depression and reaction time. There's also reduces anxiety, depression without causing drowsiness, helps reduce brain and cell destruction, stabilizes blood sugar, helps low cholesterol, helps offers anti-inflammatory benefits, obtains anti-malarial properties, protects the brain cells against the deleterious effects of our modern lifestyles, relieves stress, anti-cancer properties, and has stable Ayurveda medicine for over 3,000 years. But what's interesting, this study shows actually the effects of the ashwagandha root, how it helps to decrease cortisol. So studies done, significant reduction in cortisol. And also the actual mean score for perceived stress scale. So that's been some really good studies to show it works. It's not just, I think, I have an idea. they've had studies show it does work. So it does have a theme of calmness. That's what's important about this group. Now, rhodiola has been around for quite a long time. It reports back in 77 AD. The Greek physician Dioscorides, he just documented the medical applications of the plant. The Vikings depended on the herb to enhance their physical endurance and strength. I mean, way back when. I mean, how long ago we have Egyptians using things we use today? I mean, it's really been pretty clear that we have, even today, things we use that have been used for centuries and centuries. And so we see the people of Central Asia consider this tea brewed from rhodiola rosacea to be the most effective treatment for what? Cold and flu. Also, the Chinese emperor sent expeditions to Siberia to bring back called the golden root for medicinal preparations. And then, of course, the Soviets use it for a lot of things. To compete with the West in military development, arms race, space, Olympics, science. I mean, they'll do anything to get ahead of us, I'm sure. Even use rhodiola. And, of course, they can't test for it. Then, of course, the thing that's important about this particular supplement, it improves anxiety disorders, enhances production of neurotransmitters, very important part. Memory is improved, performance improved, reduces stress-related heart damage and its recovery, increases fatigue and ease exhaustion, helps to increase attention span, improves endurance levels, aids in fat loss, anti-cancer, improves regulation of blood sugar, protects the liver from environmental toxins, and also lowers cortisol levels. So we're seeing all these supplements beginning to work together to try to bring down the cortisol as much as we can. Then bacopa, interesting product, has been clearly shown to diminish attention deficit disorders. We use it a lot in ADD along with L-tyrosine. L-tyrosine has been our main way to reduce the ADD. L-tyrosine, in fact, we don't use Adderall or Ritalin anymore. We use gluten-free diet, tyrosine, and we use even Razin to help to bring down the problems associated with ADD. We have a test called a WABI, a brain test that we do. It gives about a 98% accuracy of diagnosing ADD. So it's a pretty interesting study we're doing for that purpose. It helps reduce anxiety and stress, obviously supports awareness and perception, improves attention span, lowers mental fatigue, improves memory, enhances emotional state, and positively influences the brain cells that promote generation of the brain tissue. Also enhances liver detoxification from detox exposure, encourages normal blood pressure, fights systemic redness and swelling, strong antioxidant activity, a nootropic, aptogenic, and also may negatively react with some anticholinergic medications and effectiveness of drugs for Alzheimer's. So you gotta be careful if you have a drug for Alzheimer's that you may be using. And of course, acetyl L-carnitine is really an important part of Razin. It transports fatty acids into the mitochondria where they're burned for energy. It improves, of course, the angina, heart function, and exercise tolerance in patients with coronary artery disease and heart disease, boosts mental energy, and enhances endurance in older people, and reduces fatigue and muscle loss, and enhances, of course, cognitive function. And, of course, the other thing that enhances our memory and concentration through acetylcholine, and lessens oxidative stress and damage in the brain, helps in the regeneration and repair of neurons, and slows neuronal decline. So another really good product in this area. And of course, B6 is something that we have known for years, helps the levels of homocysteine in the blood. And that's when we have a high homocysteine, we know homocysteine over a long period of time can be causing an acute risk of what? Blood clots or strokes and also of heart damage. So that's why B6 plays a major role in that, along with basic folic acid. Needed to absorb vitamin B12, of course, this is what why we like to see B6 with B12 when it comes to homocysteine issues. Needed to make red cells and to make cells for immune system. Primary role in creating a healthy nervous system needed by the body to make neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, and melatonin. B6 is such an important vitamin. And the last thing is melatonin. Now, we talked about that earlier. Melatonin, of course, is something that if someone said they can't sleep at night, and cortisol goes up at nighttime, you've got to get them to sleep 78 hours. If you don't, they're going to have cortisol up every night, and they're just going to have problems with their weight, problems with their cholesterol, their LDL. I mean, it just doesn't help him to resolve that problem. So natural sleep aids, some of the things over the counter, you know, they take, well, I'm going to take a little bit of Benadryl. Well, it may not work too well. But the main thing is our pineal gland produces melatonin. Our pineal gland has been compromised by cortisol. So why not give melatonin? It makes sense. So melatonin helps. It also is a potential treatment for breast and prostate cancer. There have been some reported cases. Not the treatment, but a helpful treatment possible. Decreases negative menopause symptoms, heart disease helper, fibromyalgia, chronic relief of pain, immune system strengthener, enhances, eases jet lag, and better outcomes for autism in children. It also, I found out, is a pretty good antioxidant as well. So I do think that melatonin would be something we should consider. When I have anybody come in and say, I can't sleep at night, I have interrupted sleep, I go to melatonin, I give them some kind of at bedtime, a Rezin, and I'll give them 5-HTP, I'll give them Cavanase, and the kitchen sink, all I can. And be surprised at how many people just have trouble sleeping. I mean, you've had trouble sleeping a lot, haven't you? And so you see, it's terrible. Can't get any rest at all at night. It just makes your whole day go downhill. So that's why it's important to address sleep as much as we can. So now we're down to the last slide here on the treatment that I'm going to show you. One more thing that we'll be through for this afternoon. So what we need to do, and this is the difficult part. How do you make people not be stressed out? Well, first of all, I encourage you to do lifestyle changes, what we talked about earlier. Secondly, tell them to delegate. I tell people all the time, what are you doing? You are a CEO of a company, and you have 500 employees. You need some help. Delegate. You know, I tell them there. I ask them what their problem is. I get into their whole life, practically. Say, no, you need to delegate. You know, you can't do it all yourself. I know you're the only one that's smart enough to do it, you think. But you have to hire someone who you can trust to do it. Otherwise, you're going to stress yourself out. You don't want to be that 51-year-old guy that in good health, muscular, goes, you look like, you know, Captain America, runs around Joker Park and has a heart attack and dies, do you? Because that's what happens when you get too much stress. You can have angina, you can have a heart attack. But you have to really get down to all these things. You can tell it come to delegate. I remember, you can't change others. Oh my gosh, I see all the time. Oh, I can't, I tell my son not to drink that alcohol or to smoke pot. I said, you can't tell him not to do that. He's not going to listen to you. He's going to want to do it himself. He's going to make himself change. You can talk to him, he's blue in the face. You can write recommendations, but you can only change yourself. We can't change anybody as much as you want to. You'd love to, but you can talk to that wall there. It's not going to take any suggestions from him. But you have to encourage him. Maybe get him some help. Get him to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Maybe they can talk him out into the right thing, but maybe not. They have to want to do it. And they'll say, well, he's still, you know, now he's on heroin. I said, well, I had a grandson who's on heroin. And he was 25 now. He's been in rehab three times. He lived with three other people that died with overdose. He still, every time each one died, he went to rehab and came back out and did it again. Finally, he lived under the bridge. I took him his clothes. He didn't want them. He just lived at the bridge for 3-4 days. I told my son, let him stay there. You can't bring him back and pamper him. After the third time, he finally said, I think I've had enough. And he went to rehab for 9 months. He now has a job, 25 years old, lives in an apartment, drug-free, knock on wood. But sometimes it takes tough love. And I tell this to our patients, you know, so you can't make them do things they don't want to do. And it's tough, and it's hard. So, learn to say no. Oh, Lord. Well, guess what? I just got, you know, a new assignment to volunteer for this. I said, do what? Volunteer again? Why did you do that? I just can't say no. You got to say no sometimes. They don't do that. So you think things are bad, always think the glass is half full, not half empty. I tell that so many times. You know, just think it could be worse. But try to keep a positive attitude all the time. The glass is half full, not half empty. And before you do anything or make any decisions, take a deep breath or count to 10. Don't overreact. I mean, that's so common for people to overreact before thinking about what they're going to say or do, and they made the wrong decision. Just think about it and pause for a moment before you do something. Be patient with others, consider their feelings and options. This is something that is sometimes hard to do. And I know that we see this so many times where they just basically, all they think about is their own feelings. They don't think about others' feelings. This is not easy, but you have to tell them to stop for a moment and think about what you're trying to do and make sure they consider others as well. The last thing I tell them to do is pray. I pray for patients almost every week. They need a lot of prayer. And they appreciate that too. And I had a lady the day, about maybe a month ago, that came in. She says, "What's wrong?" I says, "You're stressed out. Your sex hormone glycogen is sky high." I told her that before when she sat down. She said, "Well, my husband asked me for a divorce." I said, "Oh, really? Today?" "Yeah, this morning." I said, "Well, I can tell. How many children do you have?" She said, "I have 4 girls." I said, "So what are you going to do?" She says, "Well, he wants a divorce." I said, "Tell him no. Tell him that you want to get a counselor." "Why?" "Because it's full of 4 girls. Not for you. Not for him, it's for 4 girls." Tell him you're not going to take a divorce as an option. You want to do counseling because you're doing it for those kids. "You go ahead and tell him I said so." Well, she did. And he said, "Okay." So they went to counseling. I saw her last week. She said, "So far, so good." But see, sometimes you have to be bold. At my age, I can say anything. As an old man, you don't worry about me. But the point is, that's why you have to be bold in what you do. You got to be positive what you're thinking, and you have to take consideration of what everybody's doing. Now comes the last thing, and this is something that I think it's important because it's going to be all about me. But it tells me one thing we all need to know. What is the incidence of diabetes going to be in 2050? 1 in 3 people in the world. Forecast. It's on the rise because of obesity, insulin resistance, I mean everything. That means 1 in 3 people in this world have diabetes if we don't do something about it. In the United States as well. Now, we all know the effects of diabetes. I mean, you have so many things. You have amputation, you have dementia, you have heart attacks, you have all sorts of problems. I had a test done by a neurologist about 2 years ago called it's a test for cardiac variability. They call this a tilt test. They put you on the table for 2 hours and do all sorts of fancy things, you know. They came up with a diagnosis based upon that, which was sort of reduced valsalva ratio, so whereby poor heart variability, secondary diabetic autonomic neuropathy, and suggesting small nerve involvement, digital correlation advised. Well, obviously at that time, I had clearly what I would call, I had neuropathy in my feet. I was on insulin-dependent diabetic. I did too much drinking and carousing around when I was young, and I love sugar, and I didn't give it up. I love chocolate. I mean, that's the way it is. So when you don't practice what you preach, you get in trouble. So now that's what I have, so I had to deal with it. So what I did was to try to change things around. But if I'm going to tell you what my first HRV looked like, and this is pretty classic for someone who has autonomic neuropathy. You have a very low, basically, standard deviation, very high. In fact, my pitch index up to about 700 at one time, and a very high based on autonomic balance showing agitation and a very high heart rate. So if I have a diabetic that has all these parameters on there, and if they have any neuropathy in their feet and their sugars are high, I tell them that you're on the course of getting diabetic cardiovascular autonomic neuropathy if we're not careful. My brother died of this 4 months ago. He was 78 years old. He had a stage 4 or 5 kidney disease. He didn't take care of himself at all. And I'll tell people that have these findings here with diabetes and their sugars are somewhat uncontrollable, if you're not careful, this is going to happen to you. And if you're not careful, you're going to end up doing some things that I've had done, and you can prevent that if you listen to what I have to tell you. So we're looking at, what does it do? Well, I'm in a sympathetic mode all the time. My vagus nerve has been compromised by sugar, by glucose. That's what this autonomic neuropathy is. This two expert in the world, Dr. Rulin in Colombia, and also in eastern Virginia, has written a great, great paper on this, summarized in the world's literature. It's a compromise of the vagus nerve, the sympathetic nerve. Different parts of it now. It doesn't say all of it. It just says different parts of it have been compromised. So if my heart rate was up, my heart was increased in size, and I had increase in my blood sugars from probably a stimulation of the adrenal gland, most likely. But the point is, somewhere along the line, parts of the vagus nerve had been compromised. So what happened? I had 3 stents put in 2015. I had a triple bypass in 2016 because it didn't work. And then I had, after about 2 months after the stents were put in, I still had shortness of breath. Now, why did I have any angina? Because if you have no parasympathetic vagus nerve, you don't have pain. You don't have angina when you have only sympathetic stimulation. So that's why I say you can have cardiac disease but not have angina because of no parasympathetic response. So I got ejection fraction was 19% because of the, obviously because of the problem with the cortisol problem. Mild ventricular hypertrophy. So they put me on a beta blocker, which is classic, according to the guys in the literature, valsartan and statin drugs. Then I had access to a very famous holistic cardiologist, Dr. Steven Sinatra, who says CoQ10, magnesium L-carnitine, the ribose will help to cure cardiac myopathy. Within 6 weeks, my ejection fraction was 51%, just by doing that. The ribose is for the heart muscle. It helps it beautifully. My weight loss, I got down to 15% body fat, decreased my carbohydrates down, my hemoglobin A1C is now 6.5, it's gone down quite a bit. Exercise 5 days a week, increased muscle mass. There I am doing basically leg press of 750 pounds. These guys at the gym said, what the hell is that old man doing lifting so much weight? I said, because I can. I'm on growth hormone. I'm on testosterone. I do all that stuff. Meditation 30 minutes a day. I talked about that earlier. Breathing exercises, basically 10 minutes a day. Vitamin C, magnesium, practice what I preach. NBHZ, probiotics, digestive enzymes, protease, every day. Alpha-lipoic acid. Now, this is interesting. Alpha-lipoic acid, by this Dr. Relin, has shown that that will help to restore the nerves in this. Now, it may take a year, he said, but if you keep on alpha-lipoic acid, that's why I started doing an IV, because my gut is probably healthy now because of all the enzymes, but I want to add some more intravenously just in case. So I take it intravenously every week, 150 milligrams. I'll do this for the next year and see if I can restore, basically, these nerves a little bit faster if I can. And, of course, melatonin for sleep at night and addressing the stressors. And that's not easy. Still work 40 hours a week. See a lot of patients. Have 16 grandkids and 6 kids and 7 great-grandchildren and trying to keep them all happy and, you know, go in the right direction has been a challenge, but I do. So you see, this is the kind of thing that if we look at the fact that over the last year, I was able to decrease basically by things quite often. I drop, of course, I'm on the drug, which is the beta blocker. That's why I have a very negative when it comes to the autonomic balance. But you see, I dropped down my tension index fairly good, 288, 192, 160. And I've also helped increase my standard deviation up to 31. So it's improving. So it's, it may take another 6 months, but if you do all this, the point of all this presentation is that we want to try to help diabetics. And with 1 in 3 people having diabetes over the next several years, we want to focus on that as much as we can. Now, this last one here shows you a very interesting phenomenon that we talked about earlier. I tested out my saliva versus the HRV in one day where I did 8, 12, 4, and 8 saliva tests to match. What you see, a gradual, basically, decrease in the standard deviation and a gradual increase in the tension index. As my cortisol went up, these things went up as it's supposed to, and this went down, but in the evening, the cortisol went down, but it should have gone up because my standard deviation was down, and so is my tension index up, which means that by the evening, the cortisol probably blooded my receptors, and therefore the cortisol level should have been higher, but because of the receptors have been somewhat blooded, it went down. So that means that saliva testing probably doesn't represent the true case of stress. I think HRV clearly is the way to look at stress. Until these numbers become normal, until we get up to 100 the standard deviation and a zero down here on your tension index and without medication. And by the way, this is pretty good. 16 is not too bad, but the point is that we still have a long ways to go. So in summary, what I would like to see is that we can use this, the HRV, for many reasons, for stress, but also in the prediction of stress and severe complications of diabetes. Because diabetes is clearly on the rise. And I think that if we use this method of watching for a bad standard deviation, a bad tension index with a tachycardia, with hemoglobin C elevated, with a little bit of peripheral neuropathies, that we talk about people being at risk for this diabetic cardiovascular neuropathy, tell them that the consequence could be something a little less than death, that they ought to be able to be a little more aggressive. Now, what the aggressive treatment is, get your weight down, control your sugars down to down below 6.5, besides your weight, exercise, I mean, you keep your cholesterol down. Nothing wrong with statin drugs, by the way. There's been a lot of negative stuff about statins. Now, I believe in them, but I believe in small doses, 10 milligrams. I take 10 milligrams of atorvastatin, but no studies show that it's not a problem. I don't have any leg cramps at all because I'm taking CoQ10. So I do think that statins, if you have a statin problem, it's very rare, but CoQ10 is important. Secondly, if you have any plaques in your arteries, the statin hardens the plaques so they won't break off. That's why I think it's good. So there's a good reason to take statin drugs because it prevents fracturing of that plaque, keeps it solid, and there's also some suggestion it may reduce the cholesterol out of the plaque in a long-term studies, possibly do that. Okay, that should be it. Now, anything else? Any other questions at all? Yes?
What form of vitamin C do you take?
I go to HEB, buy vitamin C in a big bottle. I don't know. Score gas. That's all I do. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Did you the two doctors again, the one from Dr. Zell?
The one from Zell is Dr. Luis Rolim, R-A-L-I-M. And the one in Eastern Virginia, Eastern Virginia Medical School, is Dr. Vinicki, V-I-N-I-K, Vinicki. And both of them have written the articles, the world's largest series of studies on diabetic cardiovascular autonomic neuropathy. Pretty good, really good studies. Summarizing for, I mean, really good. Now, talking about HRV, HRV, how important it is, really is good.
Have they done any studies yet with this HRV treatment specifically for diabetic patients?
Well, they use the, to answer your question, not really, as I can see. But my point is that the HRV, to me, comes to the ability to tell us when there's been some resolution of that vagus nerve being restored. That's what it is going to tell us about. Our parasympathetic has been compromised. And that's what it shows us when we look at that. And until that vagus nerve has been restored, then we're not going to see basically any changes in the HRV or the standard deviation or the tension index. What has to happen though, I've got to stop the beta blocker, I've got to stop the valsartan for my blood pressure and see if the autonomic balance is still in the right level, which I'll do every so often just to check it out. But no one's ever done that.
Yes. So those HRV reports, so I use it for mental health, right? Anxiety and depression.
Yes.
The baseline. So those two that I saw, that's the standard for anxiety disorder. So your two that you showed up there initially with the agitation and then the tension index being at a like close to a bottom, that is a typical anxiety disorder person that I see.
Yes.
That's what they look like.
Yes. Yeah. That's good.
Depression is the opposite though.
Yeah.
Depression is imbalance, but high tension.
Yeah, high tension, yeah.
Yeah, which is really interesting.
Yeah, we see the same thing. When we do the HRV, we also do the brain scan. It picks up anxiety and depression or brain scan. We test out the beta waves, the theta waves, and the alpha waves. And we're doing the HRV, the WABI, brain scan, we can really correlate things real well. It's pretty interesting how we do all those together. WABI? The company makes it called WABI. It doesn't mean it's not a abbreviation for anything. Just WABI is the name of it, the actual brain scan. But it's really interesting how we do it. It's only takes about 20 minutes.
How long do you have to be off of the beta blocker?
7 days. Yeah.
Several days before I do that tilt test, what would make a difference about 7 visits?